Steve's back. Steve is back in the saddle again. He's back. Steve is back.
All right, folks, welcome to the Muskie 360 Podcast, a Jaybird.
Hey, Steven, what is going on?
Finally made it back.
You're back in the saddle again?
Back in the podcast saddle right here, right at my pony, in the words of Genuine. Made it back to Tennessee. So
yeah, that must have been one heck of a drive from Canada.
It was a good one. It's a good one. Boys, you know how they have those, who traveled the furthest to be here today? I definitely cover some mileage there every year. And you know, I mean, goodness, I mean, we've been doing phone recordings here the last bit, which we apologize, it's just far easier when I'm on the road there, but it's been a minute, Jay. I mean, it's like freaking from iCast and the whole bit. So glad to be home here for a week or two.
Yeah, it's like a month and a half, right?
Oh, yeah. It's
6 weeks plus?
Six weeks plus, somewhere like that. Normal. That's my life anymore. It's just moving and grooving. Mm-hmm. Actually be home for a little bit here, and then I got some things going on towards the end of the month there. But some fun industry shows coming up, Jay. Fun industry shows. Everybody wants to be in the tackle game.
Nothing
of note. Nothing. It just industry shows. Nothing crazy. So,
okay.
Anyway, I'll tell you. I got back and I haven't had all the time in the world to kind of digest Canada this year. You know, I had a bang up year. Very happy with it. Fished a tremendous amount of different water in different places. I kept the roads hot, Jay. You know,
asphalt was cooking.
It was cooking. The dirt roads were cooking.
Or the gravel was cooking.
Yeah, sure. All of it. They just, you know, you name it, you know it. But it's funny, I just, the vibe is different. I was telling Glenn McDonald that today. We were chatting on the phone for a minute. Mm-hmm. And it's just changing. And I don't know if that's good or if that's bad. But, you know, someone that is all, I'm pretty spectrumy and I don't like change too much.
Yeah, you know, you're talking about the vibe about the opportunity and ease of catching fish in the muskies?
No, I'm talking about just I'll just shoot it straight. The way I perceive it, like the way I kind of look at Canada is not about numbers, right? And there's a lot of fish there that are not worthy of the steal, right? And for me, it's like if I see, and I'm not being sanctimonious, please forgive me, right? We've talked about this before and kind of my feeling of like, oh, here comes a 39. How about no? You know, if somebody in the boat needs a fish, get it, right?
Mm-hmm. Right, right.
But at a certain point, it becomes like, why are we here? And I'm hearing a lot of like, oh, number stuff, and I'm not saying like anybody in particular or anything of that nature, but just like, and it was the entire time I was there of running into people. You'd be at the grocery store and it was like just the concept is different than what it once was, where it was the trophy hunt, and now it's becoming, you know, what's the goal? And that everybody can have different goals, but like I said, I got to figure
out.
I've got to figure out what I want to do, because I'm sitting there, I don't want to be around this. I don't give a shit. I don't want to be around anybody first and foremost. But it's also too, like, you know, we're hunting bigs. Did well with hunting bigs, but at certain points, like that pressure jumps around. I'm even talking goon. There's some freaking offbeat stuff that is shockingly getting beat up. Stuff you would never think was getting beat up, Jay. Like,
you're seeing numbers like there are fishermen that years.
Little side lakes of I won't name names because I don't want to burn them. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, of course.
But lakes, you got to kind of know somebody that knows somebody that knows somebody to even know how to get out there. Or, you know, and there's one thing I ran into, a lodge owner I was talking to him, and one of the bigger lodges in the area had hit him up going, hey, can we bring our people out to so-and-so Little Lake? Right? And you're like, oh, gross. You know, so just pressure. It's just the pressure's changing, and just where people are going are changing. I may have said on the podcast last few weeks, but I'll tell you, this year was a weird year. As I was kind of leaving, the last week I was there is when things normalized, right? That was the easiest week of the year. And, you know, you got stability, and they kind of went there, and you go, okay, yeah, if you want to find fish, pretty standard huck and chuck, right? Before that, it was very different. Again, to articulate it perfectly is not something I do at the moment, where I got us kind of set back. But, you know, a lot of fluctuation, colder temperatures, lack of stability, kind of checking all the boxes of things that make it a different bite. But last week, pretty stable. You know, a monkey, a grinder monkey could have got one with a spinner bait. You know what I'm saying? Like, if you threw a spinner bait and turned the handle long enough, the monkey off the pizza box would have got him one, right?
Mm-hmm.
Cool, sure. Easy. But I don't know if your pizza boxes had the monkeys on them, Jay. At least mine as a child did.
No, okay. Never seen that.
Geno's Pizza for all you West Virginia people. Okay. But he's a little grinder monkey. He had to get that.
West Virginia guy.
He cranks the box for the
monkey. Yeah.
The pizza monkey. But anyway, you know, pretty simple handle turning stuff on some stuff. But before it was like kind of, you had to be a little more particular. You got to be this, you got to be that. But it's a different year, and it's going to be funny because I always think years that are in Canada, I've seen them come and see them go, Jay, where it's difficult years, where it's kind of like throughout regions or whatever. Those are like,
well, yeah, and you had 4 weeks up there too.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So let people, you know, I mean, a lot of folks, when they go up, you know, and take their big vacation, it's usually, five, six, 7 days.
Days.
Do you hear too many? You're right. You know, do you hear too many week and a half? You know, because checkout times are regulated.
Yeah, you got week guys. You got week guys. You got 2 week guys. I mean, heck with the trade shows, I'm doing less than I did because it used to be 6 weeks, and now it's ICAST cuts into that. But anyway, long story short of that, you know, I've seen it. You know, it's not like the one weeker kind of thing. But difficult, and like I said, it's stabilized, and I think it'll stabilize more. But what I'm getting at is that instability in the angling. I really think it's going to shake up where the angling pressure is happening. That's what I'm getting
instability,
at.
Instability in the angling, okay?
Instability in where people are going to go.
Uh-huh.
Right? Where I was talking to Glenn about it. Again, it's like it's just my thought. I've been saying it the whole time I was up there. I don't say crappy years. It wasn't crappy for everybody, but when it comes to, okay, average angler, right?
Right.
Bucktail, top water, want to go have fun, put a couple in the boat, cool.
Sure.
Nothing wrong with that, right? When they're getting trounced and they're just blanks, zeros, coming back, you spend a week on the water, a zero, that sucks. Tough stuff.
That's,
you know what I'm saying?
Tough pill to swallow.
Right. You don't get to eat. You don't get anything. And I'm not talking like serious musk. I'm talking serious enough to go to Canada, but not like freaking living, breathing, eating, and sleeping. They just want to go on a Canada musky trip, right?
Yep.
A lot of those were blanked out. There's a lot of people that spent their entire trip, nada, zilch, nothing, handful of follows. There's guys that had some experience that went to what I would call Canadian action lakes, where multiple fish encounters and incursions per day are kind of the average, and they're getting nil, very little. I mean, it's like Glenn had told me numbers that he knew. I know some other groups where it's like, here's two boats, and they got like three for two boats on what I would say, you know, stuff that's like the equivalent. Yeah, you could get a 50, but it's equivalent of fishing like Three Lakes Chain or Eagle River. It's not like,
yeah, I get it. Right.
It's like whatever land, right?
Yeah.
And so when you have those kind of trips, I mean, I don't blame a guy when they start peeking around and going, where else should I go? And I think it's going to be interesting to see how next year pans out and where the pressure is absorbed, right? Because a lot of people are going to pull up tent stakes is what I'm getting at, Jay. It's a shuffling of the deck where how many people went to Lake of the Woods and got trounced about 3 weeks ago? There's a bunch.
that remember, like, we had some people that were affiliated with the shop got pretty rough, and remember people were leaving camp early and all that, and it's like, that's when it'll be funny. Like I said, the shuffling of the deck, I think, is what's in the cards, where people are going, oh, well, I'm going to go here because I heard it was good, or I'm going to go here because this was bad. You know what I'm saying? You check out new stuff. But well, anyway, that's just kind of my take. And, you know, trying to still digest everything and see what the main takeaway was. But I can tell you, if nothing else, of the importance of understanding structural interplay and the dynamics of weather systems and what's happening. Like, you know, I was pulling the video. Actually, I sent you some stuff. It's cool. I went with Danny, son of Herbeck.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we went out and had our fun and fooling around, but I was able to get him, and we it's like one of those things, Jay, you do it. You know how it's like you go to dinner and you got to say something about business so you can write it off on your taxes, right?
Okay.
Yeah. I went out with Danny. I was like, we better film something about Savage Gear real quick for the shop, you know?
Yeah, I was just working on that. Yeah,
right. So sent that over, and Danny was able to show you. You've got the new, we'll talk about them here in a minute. They've got some new baits at the shop, but yeah, you know what? But, you know, when I was gabbing with him and we were talking about what's taking place, what's going on in the water, how are you getting in front of big fish, all the stuff plays that even in the worst of worst conditions, that structural knowledge, structural understanding, and how that weather interplay happens, right? How wind is setting things up. And I think probably the biggest takeaway, and I'll probably comprise it, and Jay, I was, like I said, I was to the video point, I was watching some video that I had some catches there. And the thing that just keeps coming back and coming back and coming back is how things set up, right? And how important it was to identify how things were setting up before that happened, right? So when bites are fluctuating and things are changing, that conceptualization of what does this look like across the lake now, or you know, the wind shifted from this, what idea does that supplant in your brain, right? Okay, it's an east wind, because I can tell you, I caught fish in all different, but you had to, right? You had to think about every single day the wind was shifting there for a couple weeks. I mean, there was a south wind one day, literally middle of the day, me and Bob were out there, shifts due north, right? Next day, southwest. It's just shifting.
You were catching fish no matter what the wind direction, and making adjustments
And the adjustments had to be made to have success.
They had to be made, right?
Right.
Yep.
And something that and it was kind of like a neat moment and something at least noteworthy worth sharing. As Herbeck, Steve said something that I thought was pretty cool. He was talking about, we're just on the boat, and he wasn't trying to say it. He was just in the moment doing.
Yeah.
Right? And it's different than, hey, let me explain this to you. He just said it. He said, it's not going to bite, that fish was in yesterday's wind. And probably one of my key, like a marquee moment for me, was that in moving fish, moving some big fish, and seeing how they were staged, where they would follow from, and how they hadn't set up on new stuff because the shift hadn't changed yet.
Yesterday's wind.
Yesterday's wind.
I've never heard. Okay. Okay.
But you can find fish in it, but they're not set up to predate. We were finding them. You know, you got your down scan, you got your follow scope, you got all your stuff kind of there, right? And you're there before they've made their move. So they were eating yesterday on, say, whatever wind. And you're kind of in that flux, and nothing's really set up again. And then lickety-splickety, here comes the hard wind shift of the day. I don't know how they know it's coming, but it seems like they do. Mm-hmm. And they're just kind of residing in those areas that had set up yesterday, right? So take a rock bar or reef, think Canada, here's a big rocky point, here's a big reef, whatever the hell it is. It was blowing, you know, and they're sitting in they're sitting on the windblown side, or they're sitting on the slack water that side, whatever it is. Well, they're not. Where do they go? They don't go home. The lake's home already.
True.
And here they are. They're just waiting for that shift. And we were stumbling into them. And they weren't reacting great, but they had real lazy lookers. You ever get those real lazy follows, right? Boom, wind shifts. They actually set up on the other side of stuff, and now they meant business. It was pretty cool to see of how that played. And I actually picked his brain about it subsequently. I was like, you've seen that a bunch, haven't you? He said, more than
I was just
going to
say, I bet you did. Yeah.
Oh, that was to me.
Was
a new
very
one.
Aware of.
Yeah. And that was like kind of a new, well, and it's one of those things like in the first book of Next Level Muskie Fishing, when I talk about reading the water, he and Booker are the people that I use as examples, right? And those are just, and Herbie knows Eagle better than anybody else does. Just period.
Yeah,
and
for sure.
And
yeah.
Seeing that and just going, oh, man. Well, they're there because that was what was happening, but they're not responding because it's not it now. Right? That's it now. They're there, and it was, but it's not it. You know what I'm saying? It sounds like rhymey, but it was kind of neat to see that. And we were really kind of, he started showing me that. He's like, well, this is where they'll be because it was happening there. This is where they're going.
That's cool.
And you know, playing that, did that a little bit on some other stuff, kind of not the same concept per se of what he had said. It was, okay, this was yesterday's win, but going transitional zones, things we've talked about, because it ties back into the structure fishing thing of everything. Obviously, everything interconnects and they have to be somewhere, right? They don't have to be predating, but they're going to be somewhere, and it's kind of funny to see that in play. And I'd say the other thing, just to see in real time, because Danny Herbeck has talked about when we did the Canadian, his show, and I had to fill in for Coop there. And, you know, I've been saying it, and kind of the motif has been when fish are roaming or when things are happening sporadically, that you really need to know where to intersect those fish. You know, and it really became a structural thing of not guessing, going, okay, it should be X, Y, and Z side of the basin, right? We got this wind that would make the most sense. What structural elements set up best in the wind or this direction or that change? So just kind of a takeaway, just something to think about of how they're setting up. And like I said, my favorite kind of thought process or my favorite kind of takeaway was that yesterday's wind thought. And like I said, trying to rectify that a little bit and see how that impacts. But anyway.
Yeah, I like that. I like that. I never heard that put that way before, and it's very interesting. It's thought-provoking, so that's cool.
Thought-provoking. I'll tell you what's wallet-provoking. The comings and the goings at the Muskie Shop, Jay. It's wallet-provoking. Yeah. I'm in front of a computer that works again here.
I was taking some pictures today. Yes, sir.
Sausage gear. Jay, he's editing it now. I went out with the man, the myth, the legend from Sausage Gear himself, Danny Herbeck.
Oh, Savage Gear?
Savage. Them and
yes, sir.
Johnny
Bob.
Johnny Depp.
You know what RTF stands for?
Retarded.
Ready to fish. Oh, come on now.
I thought it was RFT is what I said on the boat. Well, there's actually an outtake. If we had a bloopers video, actually.
Beep.
Yeah. It was good.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Uh-huh.
Been there.
Anyway.
Heard it.
You gotta get the hot takes and outtakes tonight. My outtakes are just all start with a fuss sound. Anyway, we've got the 9-inch RTF ready to fish. Unlike all other baits available, these are ready to fish.
Well, they're not line through for starters. Yes, they're ready to go. Yeah, and those are nice. JJ gives a big old thumbs up on that. Actually, shot the 9 and the 13. Got some footage on those. But did the 11-inch today. It's the middle size. There's a 9. There's an 11. There's a 13. You know, they range in weight from about 6 to 11 ounces roughly.
Yeah,
and they've got a removable weight system. All you got to do is take the front hook off and drop the weight off, and it's a very shallow swim bait with that. But they've got rattles in the tail, and this thing is putting out noise. Mm-hmm. You know, you got to audibly, you have to pay attention to that. I don't hear other people mentioning that, but when we film that thing underwater, you could hear it above water if you get it moving pretty quick. So, it's a swim bait. Yeah, it rolls. It's got a great paddle system, and, you know, it's Savage Gear classic. You know, not paint work, but body work.
Yeah,
the reel is fantastic.
Yeah, we were throwing them, and what a lot of people don't realize inside that body is there's actually a plastic block to keep them from bending over, and that's what's there, because you'll see baits fold in the air when you get to the longer models, right? You ever get like a dog ball?
You're casting
a bulldog, or you're casting a completely soft swim bait, and they'll roll over. That's what that little dealio is in there, and that's where they're able to get the rattle. So,
yeah, I've seen it happen to other people.
Yeah, so that prevents the rollover. They're pretty good. What else you got? Lake X Epoxy.
We got a surprise shipment out of nowhere. Yeah.
There you go.
So we got some cannonballs in, folks, but they're sold out.
I think I was about
they're
to
sold
say
out
I think
in 2 hours.
Yeah, that's every one of them was shipped to Minnesota, I'm betting. I would bet. They're hard to get.
The cannonball is like a nine, what is it? Over 9 ounces, I think. This is a massive tail bait, got a Cannonball Junior short out, so you can hear that thing, what it sounds like. She's a clacker, not a clacker, a thumper, a spanker. It's just
a spanker, folks.
Yeah, even some Dr. Evils and Fat Bees, and got some more hammers in, so that was cool.
Very good. Well, with the epoxy. What? Hold on for a second.
Now
we're talking. Now here's some shit.
Mm-hmm.
The Lure Doctor. What is going on here?
You're going down a bit.
The Lure Doctor is a soft plastic bait repair tool to repair, fuse, and weld soft plastic lures back together. If you fish swim baits, okay. Unlike high-heat torch knife methods, the Lure Doctor is designed to control soft plastic welding so you can target damaged areas and create a clean, solid repair.
Well, interesting. Front to back. That was really good.
I've not seen this. So
it's got a little USB thing. Plug it into your laptop or phone, and
is it just like a? All I'm saying,
it's basically a pen. You take the cap off. There's a video on there attached from the Lure Doctor folks.
Right.
I don't know where they're out of, but it's just like you just take that.
Well, that's your Waterwolf bait. So probably a Canadian.
Yeah, he ripped a bait. He literally ripped a bait in half, and then just went down the whole circumference of the bait.
I'm seeing it. Yeah.
Damn.
So it's like it's a USB hot knife.
More or less.
What will they think of
apparently.
Next? Yeah, I
yeah.
would. I
mean, it's a cool little deal. They're not pricey, so.
Yeah. Can you, questions everyone's, that I have.
Everyone's experimented with glue, and we all know how temporary that is of a fix for most items.
Yeah, well, you get the frickin' mended. Nothing wrong with mend it, but good God, is it like you get that on your hands, you're not getting it off. Okay, that looks like a pretty good repair. I'm interested. I'm going to have to get my hands on one of those and see what we can do with that.
Okie dokie.
That's pretty cool. Interesting.
Yeah.
It's neat to see a new concept. I've not, like I said, that was truly scrolling there and saw that and went, what in the heck? Mm-hmm. What do you know? Now, that's it. That'll be interesting to see. Hopefully, I'm wondering if that'll operate in a wet environment. You know, I don't know if it says do not use, but I mean, that's always the problem. Like if you got to glue baits together, inevitably it's raining. I'm serious. That's just my life.
Coming from past experience.
Oh,
sure.
I have the back in the day of everything had to have a soft tail and there's no screw on stuff. Yeah, because that's my thing with like the Titan. I went through, we had a couple days where the Titan was just, you know, that was it. And it's always like the worst condition days. Nobody's catching anything. You're like, okay, I know what I'm throwing. And, you know, you get a couple of hammer handles. So like the screw on tail, but God, back in the day, it was like you would get some hammer handle pike rip the tail off a glide bait and you're up under the console trying to create a dry environment. So
trying to create a dry, and waiting, not knowing if that particular glue is going to work with that particular type of plastic, because they all vary. There's so many different, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm looking here. What else we missed? Yeah, I'm catching up here.
Okay.
With the Lexus, you got the free Bessie. So
yeah,
I could,
that's a that's one you gave a thumbs up to. That's actually a cool lure. Yeah,
that is a sleeper, by the way. And coming off of turbid water, where clacking and whacking. Jay said spanking it earlier. So if you like the spanking it sound of a fat bastard, the old clicky clack, that Bessie, the floating Bessie's pretty ridiculous. And I've caught some fish on that thing, and it's kind of like a globe with a spanker on it, if you will. Spanker.
Not a spanky, but a spanker. You got it.
Good God. But no, that's a pretty interesting bait. So they've got that coupled up with that. What are they floating or the sinking model Bessies that come with? Do you know?
I think most of the ones we have are sinking, actually.
Which is like, well, the sinking is super slow, so you can actually what I like about that is you can like work it on top at the beginning and then like let it slow down and gum down. So that's cool. What else we got? Fish Monkey. They got some gloves.
That's a brand new waterproof glove.
Nice.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. New BKK.
Falls right around the corner. Mm-hmm.
Lee has made some flap tails here, and that's another spanker in my book. Yeah. And what else we got going on here? Predator or the Savage Gear Scandal. So did hang out with, again, Danny of the Herbex and going through all this stuff. Last year, the scandal wasn't out, right? And one of those baits that we were rocking, locked and loaded on that thing. I'm telling you. And it's one, if they see it, they're going to look at it. And I'm sure Danny said that in his stuff he's put out. But, when a bait's good, I give the credit where credit's due. And that's one of those baits that if you can get it in front of one, it's going to check it out. And I actually had, Steve Herbeck's boat, tons of shit in it, right? He's in it. It's funny. Somebody asked me up there, do you only throw, and if you listen to the podcast, you know the answer. Like, do you only throw Livingston? I'm like, no. I throw everything, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's like from working with the Muskie shop, I even told the people at Livingston, I'm not going to be excluded. I'm not just going to throw that. There's a time and a place for a little bit of everything. And so, I was in Herbie's boat, and we were having one day, it was pretty freaking slow. It was just one of those days. And of course, he's got Danny Scandal in there. Pick that thing up, and here came just one that'd make you gulp a couple times, Jay. It was right on her. We thought it was going to eat kind of deal, but it just didn't. Just kind of did that. What blimps do, slowly descend into the ether, right? Just kind of disappear like they were never there. But
use that look.
But I've caught on that bait before, and it's a heck of a bait. So the Scandal, like I said, it's a little pricey, but you're getting a lot of bait for that. Oh, other than that, pretty exciting. Pretty exciting, crazy, wacky stuff, Jay.
It sure is.
Crazy, wacky stuff, and I'm sure you've seen it before that. All that apparel stuff's back in. So what do we got cooking here in the old mailbag?
The mailbag, okay.
The mailbag. Oh, hey, teaser on this one.
What's that?
Hopefully, I was told today, the ship has landed that's going to have this crazy topwaters some people saw at the bash. Some of that stuff. Hey, more on that later, but some of that will be here very shortly.
Sounds like it's right around the corner.
It's gonna be right then and there. All right, John, getting into trolling, running suckers a bit, and going to lake. I'm not gonna spot burn it. Oh, he's Namakagan. Don't see much discussion on actually what to use for trolling line. You guys recommend braider mono? Okay, so make it easy for you here. And he also wants some trolling tips. We're going to troll 80-pound braid, right? And obviously, I recommend next level braid. It doesn't matter. Just freaking run whatever braid. So the only thing I don't recommend for trolling is I don't recommend Cortland Master braid because it does absorb a bit of water and it will sink, right? So Nothing wrong with that. Not knocking Courtland Master Braid. It's a nice braid, but it can give you slightly varying results if you're like super anal retentive like I am, where it has to be just perfect, right? So just get you some braid, be done with it. We've talked about in the past, and we've touched on different odd applications. I think somebody asked about wire trolling here recently. I've talked about mono applications. If you are generally doing just absolute general trolling, or you're new to trolling, troll 80-pound braid. Just do it. That's it. So October trolling, though. Great time, in my opinion, to troll. You definitely have a shallow bite setting up, but you always have those open water staging fish. So October, Namakagan, I'm going to go big. I think you're wasting time. And it's like I was talking about Canada earlier, Jay. Like, if we're going to do numbers somewhere else. If we're trophy hunting, trophy hunt. Maybe Canada's now just the new playground to catch dinks. But for me, it's like I want to go for number, or I don't want to go for numbers. I want to focus on something different. If I'm going to Namakagan, or you going somewhere, my school of thought is go big. Don't waste your time. So I'm going to go 12-inch Supernaturals. I'm going to go with those 13-inch Grandmas, Legend Plows. You know, and get into a bigger game there. Don't waste your time, because a lot of times it's just as hard to get that 40-inch bite as that 50-inch bite. You know what I'm saying? That's going to be kind of the motif there. Cody, I really enjoy river muskie fishing and primarily target the Wisconsin River. I'm fairly dialed in on fish when the water flow is fast. However, where should I target fish during drought conditions when water temperature is high, flow is slow, and water levels are down like this year? They seem to be avoiding slack water this year and near the main channel. Also, many of the fish are eating small baits. Any feedback? Okay, so love moving water. That's kind of my comfort zone as well. Right? Now, something to hearken back. Because I have Canada on the brain, Jay. Most of the stuff in Canada has current, right? And that's one thing people just have the hardest time.
It's got a dam.
And there's a lot of water coming out of that son of a bitch. But whatever. I'll let you say it's a lake. But we'll all move on and agree it's a reservoir, because we're not retarded here. But moving water is obviously current-based. You know, it's not just wind-driven current. We have actual flow current. So in a true river situation like this, when flow is lessened, right? What if you're looking at what was typically, and if you make the comparison, if you're juxtaposing high water and low water, yeah, that slack water that they would typically be in is shifted. It will shift out. Like he said, they're closer to the current. It's shifting out. So you got to look at it as is. It can't just be, okay, last year it would have been here. It's like day-to-day reading. They're going to get tighter that, because a lot of times, like he's saying, that water is going to be warmer. You know, the less water we have moving, the warmer you're going to get in those slack water zones. So it actually really narrows down the zone that they're using from the current and how much of that current break they'll use, Jay. Right? Now, dependent on forage. If it's truly like a panfish bite, and it's just like, okay, and there's some rivers where some small suckers, bluegills, crappie, that's like soup du jour for muskies. they'll scoot back into that slightly warmer stuff. But Wisconsin River, things of that nature, I'm going to focus still. I'm going to tighten up how much I'm targeting. I'm not going to worry about going too far back in those slack water areas. The warmer it is, you know, you get in that mid-70s, things of that nature. Most of the time, they're like right on that edge. Right on that ambush edge, just hanging loose there. You know, and it's not that like a total avoidance of the slack. It's they're just right as it begins. It seems like they're in the current, but they're just laying right on that edge, just waiting for something to slide in and out of there. And, you know, what will happen if you have really lessened current or really slow flow and slow days, you'll see them become more transient, right? It seems like a little bit more roaming because the food conveyor is not coming to them, Jay, right? Where you'll find in slow water or low water years, you'll find very condensed
zones of everything. A lot of that is thermal, right? River fish like are cold most of the time. You know, they'll spend most of the time in that cool flow. So I'm going to concentrate on the deepest areas you have access to, right? And that provides a little bit more stability for them to move in and out and feel comfortable. They're not going to end up high and dry or too hot. So that would be the thing. And he's also saying smaller baits. Mm-hmm. I've always thought, and it's one of these things, in river settings, when you have low water years, right, and drought years, and I've dealt with this, whether it be like a natural river or a controlled river or whatever, low water is a condensing of everything. That means a condensing of predator and prey alike. They don't have to work as hard, right? It's not that it's kind of one of those deals for the natural forage. Well, buddy, you're trapped in here with me. So that gives the forage less place to hide, which makes muskies more efficient, right? He doesn't have to roam and run these big flats and shallows hunting stuff down or staging. Let's say, Jay, you've seen it where the height of a river can be, or the surface area of the river can be reduced by 60%.
Yep.
Right. So there's,
it's bad right now. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
it's one of those things. If you think about it from a muskie standpoint, well, what does a muskie want? He wants stability and wants to be in a zone that he won't kill himself by making a dumb mistake, and he wants available forage, and he doesn't want to work for it. Check. It's musky heaven, right? Because everything that's hiding out in these deep holes or these pockets where, and again, looking at a walleye or looking at a sucker, or looking at other fish in that system, what are their temperature preferences? A lot of that's way less temperamental than a muskie, so you can start doing the math, go, okay, where would the walleyes have to be? Not where they want to be, where do they have to be? Now, where are the muskies in relationship to that? Where do the suckers have to be? Right? Keep a sucker in 60-degree water and see how long it lasts. It's not, you know what I'm saying? There's a reason you don't have a lot of people fishing live bait in the summer. They can't even keep it alive in the parking lot. So temperature preferences or temperature limitations of forage really dictate where they're going to be in a situation like that. And like I said, you're truncating everything together. The reasons drought years that small presentation seem to be the key is muskies have it made in shade, right? They have to hunt and patrol and cover far less water, which means they have a lower caloric burn and they have food closer at their fingertips. So anytime I'm in a drought or you're in a low water period, it's often smart to downsize because of that, because they're far more efficient than they once were, right? Their caloric burn to stay with the crappie, to stay with the walleye, or stay dialed in on what they need to do to survive is lessened quite a bit. So that's a little bit of it. Jay, overall, what do you say water levels are this year? Pretty low across the board?
It's kind of ridiculous, actually. Mm-hmm. And as I say that, it's actually sprinkling, and it looks like there's some rain moving in right mm-hmm. now, so we need it bad. We're in a severe drought mm-hmm. right in this area where I live. So, rainbow flowage in the Wisconsin River system's over 6.5 feet below pool right yeah. now, which is more than usual in the late summer. Yeah. There's always a little drawdown, but still super dry weather. Super
yeah, that's, dry. That's low.
And lake level. Tom and I were out mm-hmm. shooting some short material, lure demo material mm-hmm. on Lake Catherine, south yep. of the musky shot this morning.
Yep.
And I mentioned it on the fishing report thing every last couple of weeks. It's like every day, every week we go out there, it's noticeably lower.
Yeah.
So it's for sure lost a half foot of water
uh-huh.
In the last month.
Yeah,
possibly more. So
yeah, it's crazy. Yeah,
and we were talking about that last week yep. when the boys were in. We were doing the fishing report. I asked them if they had any lakes in particular that were an actual problem mm-hmm. launching on. And they said, no, not really, but it's borderline on yeah. some of them. And, you know, in one lake, favorite of Freddie's was it has a neck down area where it gets real shallow. And normally he can get into this small lake, and he's like, I can't this year. And it's one of his crappy honey holes. You know, it's like, okay, well, you know, I probably lost a foot of water over the summer.
Oh, yeah. It's funny. Even Canada, I mean, I was having to just couple places you definitely trimmed her up if you knew what was under there. Well, I'm most years this is dicey. This year it's just downright stupid. So the whole north definitely needs some rain there for sure. But like I said, you can take advantage of it in low water situations, because like I said, from a muskie's perspective, it just makes his life easier, you know. So act accordingly. Dan, this is afternoon podcasters. He was up on Eagle River Chain in Wisconsin last weekend. And again, I went through, this might have been too, I don't know what the date on this. Dan, I apologize. We're fishing.
From Slimelander, that Dan?
No, it's a different guy.
Different Dan. Okay.
Yeah. We're fishing roughly 6 to 8 feet over weed tops and 10-foot break lines outside these weeds early morning. I caught a few small pike in the 20s over the top of the weeds. My brother, his first muskie. Although it was little and mid-20s fish, we were still using shallow rigs and swim baits. Does this pike feedback say keep fishing where we're catching pike, or go off the deeper weed line and break to target more and bigger muskies? I've heard that pike and muskie can share hunting grounds, but do you read pike bites on your muskie targeting? I haven't heard this topic on the podcast before. So, I don't have to worry about northern pike here in the south. I can promise you that. That'd be a southern pike.
Don't have southern pike. No.
No, it'd have crooked teeth. But anyway, anyway, so obviously dealing with them throughout the majority of the habitat range. And I say dealing with them as if I'll be begging to get bit by a pike out of sheer boredom here before too long, right? You don't have to buy a catch. But with northerns, there's times. And there's times that there's a massive commingling, and there's times that there's not. And again, this is back to the choose your own adventure realm, right?
Okay.
What are we after? What are we after? So if I am catching, and we got a few upper 30s, low 40 inch pike this year, targeting stuff in a deep basin, with them being present, right, check the box. Okay, cool. Right, if I'm up and I'm in hammer handle country, and we're greasing hammer handle after hammer handle after hammer handle, my personal preference is that I'm going to get out of there. Right now, he's in Eagle River Chain.
Yeah.
It depends on it. Choose your own adventure. There's not a wrong way or a right way. Do you want bigger fish, or do you want to target? You know, he got a 20-inch muskie. Congratulations. There's nothing wrong with that. If you want to crank the dial to something bigger, I'm going to get away from that, because I consider pike to be musky forage, right? I don't think, and again, it's not a, I actually talk about different forage books in the new book, but nonetheless, it's not a primary, right? But I look at the little tiny dinky pike in the same way that I'll look at the presence of, say, a bass or something like that on what I call prime musky stuff. And it's kind of like, you know, when the cat's away, the mice will play, is the way I look at it when I'm considering what's happening. If I go into an area and there's a hammer handle, boom. And then the next cast, there's a hammer handle, boom. Right? You have a decision to make. Is there a big muskie here that's going to try to eat these hammer handle pike, which is possible? Or is this hammer handle pike country and they're set up here because there's not a big muskie staged here that poses a threat?
Yeah, that's true.
And that's the reality of the matter, which is the decision hierarchy for fish is risk reward, right? They're aware of the presence of predators. Right? And if they're not, they're dead. Because we've all heard the story here. I had on a 30-inch northern pike and the biggest mouth, blah, 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 it comes up and eats him. But I tend to find a corollary between the size of pike present and the muskies present, because there's a corollary between the forage. Right? So, yes, I can draw corollaries between the size of pike and muskies present, but that corollary is actually indicative of the corollary between the forage and the predators. right? That's it. So is this a small prey, small predator situation is what you should ask? Or is this a big prey, big predator situation? It's not the pike and the muskie per se. It's a relationship between the present prey and the present predator. That's the way I address it, right? I got freaking 20-inch walleyes running around. And I got 40-inch northerns hitting. Buddy, am I getting excited, right? Because that's what I'm looking to be at in those situations. Now, you know, in Eagle River or something like that, yeah, I might back her off and go, hey, maybe we should work our way out to the deeper edge of those weeds to see, is there a bigger predator that's maybe they're working those northerns, or they're looking at slightly bigger walleye or slightly bigger panfish, right? That's kind of what I'm looking at.
Yeah, you're getting into a ton of dink hammer handles. I generally think that it's just like mature muskie. They don't want to compete with that nonsense, you know?
Right. It's And again, there's outliers on every curve. Don't get me wrong. Yeah. You know, there's the, oh, I caught two dinks and caught a 65. Okay, sure. Happens, whatever. But in general, like I said, from a patterning standpoint, look at the forage availability. And is a big muskie going to waste their time on shiners? Is a big muskie going to waste their time on juvenile panfish?
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe you're up there and there's freaking crappie the size of your hand running around and these little things are on, then we consider it that. So it's not just pike and muskie, it's the relationship of the forage. It's a deeper, it's a superficial question as everything else is in fishing, but still the real answer is deeper, which is being observant of the forage or identifying the forage and go, oh, there's clouds of minnows here and they're finger sized. There you go. Right.
Right. Yep.
Or, are there big walleye? But I mean, that's the thing too, is deep thoughts with Steve Paul here, but it's like you'll see quite often similar setups. And this is just bear with me. Let's say that we go into some weedy bay and there are dink muskies and dink northerns eating on dinky forage, right? Quite often you can take that scenario and go to a similar setup bay, say it's the same shoreline, say it's the same composition of weeds, say it's the same, and you can run into a bigger version of it, right? Because
less noise.
Well, no, it's not less noise, we have just the bigger version of it, where the mature, like let's say they're predating on sunfish. Well, you're in the bay where the small sunfish are, therefore you have the small predators. But you go, if you know where the bigger sunfish are at, you'll find bigger predators. So it's like, I'll take a small fish scenario like that and try to translate it into a bigger fish scenario, where the answer isn't always, hey, go to the deeper water, is what I'm getting at. Because the knee-jerk reaction is, should we move out deeper for big fish? What I'm trying to give is the honest assessment that I do quite often. Go, I'll run into some small fish, but okay, I need to go somewhere else where, you know, hey, sun angle's the same. For, you know, not the forage, but the composition is the same.
Yeah.
Meaning it's
10,
it's littoral zone, it's 12 feet, it's 15 feet. We know we got green weeds, we know we got this, we got that. Like a lot of the boxes are the same. Then I'll go, okay, what's the relationship to say this shoreline or this side of the lake, where you can just forego the 36s and the whatever and dinky pike, and you can ban two bays down, you're into 40 inch fish. I've seen that happen a lot, where just leaving that and going, bam, I've got a pivot. You know, I was talking about in Canada a lot about pivots, and you know, that's something to have in mind of like, okay, lake knowledge will let you quickly go, okay, bam, this is happening back here. We just moved two dink muskies. Because a bite window is a bite window. And that can be based on size of fish too. And go, you know, heck, we just moved two dinks. Maybe we go the next weed bed down and we're into something more serious. But again, choose your own adventure. You know what I'm saying? If you just want to put them in the boat. So, like I said, make those adjustments. But again, the corollary between the pike, to answer the question flatly, the corollary between pike and muskies is not a corollary between pike and muskies as much as the availability of forage.
And it's often the size of the forage is what I'm going to be looking for. Anyway, Tommy, Steve, you often harp on muskie anglers for always resorting to throwing bucktails in the weeds. My question is, what conditions need to be present for you to say, today is a bucktail type of day? Right?
Yeah, good question.
Yeah. Threw plenty in Canada, threw a lot of blade-based baits. And what I'm going to base that on is this. And let's take it down to you got just yourself in the boat. Right? I get the propensity to go bucktails from a sense of coverage. Right? Turn the handle, get the follow, maybe get the eat. I get it. They cover water well. They allow for minimal thought. You know, you just turn the handle and you can focus on driving the boat or whatever it is. Check. When I am like, bucktails matter and bucktails are the thing, it's the stacking of positives. Right? Okay. And it's not all day long. So the win, and everything's a microcosm. Like I was just talking about that freaking feeding zone of the little ones. It's, everything's a microcosm. You can't take everything as like, Tuesday's the day for bucktails.
There you go. Right.
Right. First and foremost, totally. Get that shit out of your head. Right. It is. I'm done with it.
Yeah. Right.
I mean, I met a very nice gentleman was there in Canada. We were talking about basically, well, I'm a bucktailer. Okay, cool.
Yeah. Cool.
And he's like, same thing. You sure? I catch fish. I said, I bet you do. I'm not saying they don't work. They have that is the castle that the house of muskie fishing is built around. You know, sure everything else is, and that's the way a lot of people look at bucktails. I say it because people think every other bait is a supporting role around bucktails, and that's not the way I look at the world. I look at the world quite differently. I've learned quite over the years, but I don't look at it as there's bucktails and then everything else. My denigration of bucktails is systemic of just kind of poking the bear because everybody just throws bucktails and they own crankbaits that rot and languish in their box. Right? It's the same thing with rubber. I had another conversation. You know, I'm always hooking big rubber. Why? Are you always catching? If you're always doing this and you're always catching, cool. But why is it not an ebb and flow? Nature has an ebb and flow. The muskies have an ebb and flow to what they're doing. If not, you're just sitting. I mean, it's like kind of like taking a hammer and whacking at a piece of wood until somebody puts a nail under it for you. There's your nail. I hammered a nail today. Okay, why are we not moving in, moving out, fluxing with the changes? So bucktails, to me, obviously, low light periods, all the classic stuff that you already know, most people already know. So low light periods during the spring, summer, and fall, bucktails of varying sizes are highly effective, right?
It's natural. It's a right. Low light, high in the water column presentation.
And yeah. What is low light? Low light can be sunrise, sunset, or it can be the approaching of clouds and things of that nature. They're sure, highly right. Effective. Right. If it was completely dark outside and the water was in the 70s, I would never throw anything else. Right. If the sun exploded, that's what I would throw, Jay. Right. Or if we are thrust into a never ending abyss of clouds.
Well, what if you had a total eclipse of the heart?
Well, I have. I feel turn around bright eyes.
But there anyway. You go. Right tool for the trade.
Right tool for the trade. So that's it. And there is a appropriate tool for every application. Now, when I'm thinking that, like I said, low light periods, bucktails are highly effective. As long as those are associated with stable weather patterns, things of that nature. My rule of thumb, my thought process, my treatise on all of this has been that proximity is paramount. That's it. So if a bucktail puts me in the appropriate proximity of a muskie, it is a highly effective tool. If a vertical jig puts me in the proximity of a muskie, it's a highly effective tool.
You got to think that way. Exactly.
And this is something I had a discussion about this because I put an article on the app about my usage of LiveScope. Here's how I do it. Here's what I do. And unabashed, this is what works for me, and to hell with you. Right. And a lot of it too is like everybody's got an opinion. I'm so sick of opinions. Right. Opinions often based on armchair quarterback bullshit. And so it's kind of like, here's what you need to know about LiveScope if you're considering or not, as the article that I put on there a while ago, right? Seen it, maybe you have, maybe you haven't. But with that article, is just like, okay, here's what I think it does, and here's where it'll make you weak or make you strong, whatever. But with LiveScope, it is proven time and time and time again of how close you have to be to them, right? So let's say that you have... I've done it. Don't give a shit. I know a lot of people that say they don't have it on their boat that have it. So I'm not even getting into that. I'm just talking about the reality of the thing. If you point a LiveScope at a fish in open water and you throw a bait at it and you get within 3-4 feet of it, you'll get a reaction. It will come look at it. If you land 6 feet from it, it might not even react. Right? You can throw it, reel that bait in, make the cast again, and he'll engage.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right? If he's under the boat and you see it and you're just driving by, I see it on the follow scope and go, oh, boom. Oh, if I drop this jig down and he's like down 16 feet, and if I have it in front of me, but you know, whatever, if I get it close enough, you'll get engagement. You'll get a look. It's very rare that that fish doesn't go, huh, what is this? So, my treatise or my thoughts in the pounding of proximity has been systemic of that. I've seen it.
It's a test result.
It's
not a feeling. You're not cooperating. It's just like, okay, that one had to have the bait within 2 feet of it.
And I knew, again, before LiveScope was available, I just knew it in my gut from guiding for so freaking long, right? And everybody thinks I'm a nutter where I'm set up in the front of the boat, old school style, right? Before you had these long corded trolling motors, and it works for me because I fish a lot of current situations where actually the front of the boat becomes the back of the boat. However, I use my casting as a means to slow people down. That's what a lot of people don't get, right? And Booker taught me that, and a lot of watching and all this stuff. They call it a guide cast back in the day when you only had a foot control. That was it. We got a trolling motor and they worked in the nose because it's far easier to drag the boat than it is to push it from behind when you got a 40-pound thrust brute, right? And it's kind of like you're opening and closing the angles that you give them, right? Of slowing people down. All right, well, don't cast in front of me because this is my cast, and you're slowing them down, and you go, okay, they've made 4 casts there, and bam, here it comes. Because the proximity matters of not just where the cast lands, but also the verticality of it, right? And that's one thing from LiveScope, and knew this as well from just side imaging and downscan. A fish at 12 is not going to come unglued to grab the top raider very often, right? And I'm not trying to...
Very often, yeah.
I'm not trying to shill a book, but it's like in the new book in Muskie IQ, I put together the graph. It's in the very kind of end of the book where I'm trying to put all this together, and I call it the functional awareness field, right? What a muskie can sense... And essentially what he can react to and then what he cares about at any given moment is a fluid area around this fish, right? It's how much is he going to react to at any given moment. If he's fired up and hungry, that is vast. It's big. It expands, right? The light is low. The things are this. He's functionally, he can see better. Functionally, the water's calm and he can feel more, right? You know what I'm saying? It's like it ebb and flows. And it's like there's certain things that expand that awareness field. There's certain things that contract it. Won't get into that. But in practice, starting from and I was talking to Dr. Bob about this, the funniest crap, and we talked about it years ago on the podcast, of having – a 2D downscan sonar turned on its side, right?
Okay.
And seeing fish come in, because you can take a Bondi bait and jig it off the bottom and watch that thing bounce, and you can watch a big old arch come in on it long before this shit existed.
Sure, so of course.
The proximity has been there, and now this is, like you said, this is just proof. This just wraps it up in a tight little ball, where the casting methodology has if you truncate how many casts, or you saturation cast things, right, that takes the linear plane, the flat plane, and makes it tighter proximity. And then with your presentations, the vertical proximity matters just as much. And so to the bucktail thing, a muskie at 12 and a bucktail running at 1 foot under the water, you got 11 feet, right? A crankbait running at 6, I'll bet on that. A rubber bait that's running right on that same plane, that's the one I'm putting my money on, right? So proximity vertically, proximity horizontally, however you want to see it, whatever axes you want to look at or conceptualize it about, it all boils down to, is my bait, is my lure selection, right? Bucktails, crankbaits, this is the crux of it. We're off the question, but I'm down the rabbit hole, and it's just the truth. Is your lure selection closing the proximity gap enough, right? Topwater is really appropriate when they're a foot under the surface. Super appropriate, right? Bucktails are super appropriate when they're 2 feet under, 1 foot under, in that same zone, right? Most anglers in musky fishing habitate, their all of their baits run 5 feet or less. That is most of, if we're down into 6, 10 below that, where rubber exists and deeper cranks and countdown things, asking someone to count a bait down is like asking them to punch their mother in the face. Right?
Yeah.
It is. It just simply is. I mean, like, it's funny, like, with weighting of things, of like, there's different schools of thought. You have this group of guys that their baits exist in the first 5 feet of water, and that is it, and the muskies aren't biting, and they're nowhere to be found. They're dead. They're shut down.
It's the same mythology of you know, it, like Doug Smith from The Shop, mm-hmm, long ago told me, you know, he had clients, you know, he said people get nervous when they can't see weeds.
Yep.
You know, and it was such a visual thing for me that, mm-hmm, it's a lot of people approach fishing that way, you know.
Well,
whether it's a shoreline or, you know, it's a visible weed, mm-hmm, you know, they get panicky. And they're not fishing properly because you know what I'm saying.
Yeah, I mean, I live it every day on the boat with people. And it's the same thing of like, turn the second, and it's very funny. You can always tell the first time, let's say you're fishing a shoreline leading into a point, right?
Sure.
Yeah. And this is a good way. If I get every now and then I get messages from other guides. Hey, how do you do this? Or what do you do with this? Or what are your thoughts on this? Or how do you, you know, guy, really nice guy sent me a message last week about, hey, do you fish new spots with clients? And then literally another guy said, how do you teach them how to jig? You know, and it's funny because you watch people, and the one way to gauge that if somebody's comfortable with structure is the second you start turning, like if you start at the shoreline before the point comes around, they're whacking at that, and you start turning the boat out and say, we're going to fish a point, and their cast just keep going towards the shore. And you go, okay.
Yeah.
That's the comfort level. We're going to have to address this.
You know? Part of that's communication with the clients, the guide versus the clients. Well, too. That's a whole, it's just other, like, when I fished with friends, you know, different people in the past, you know, and I'm not driving the boat, you know, it's just like, I don't know where we're at. Yeah, structure wise. And if, you know, if I can't see a locator or something, it's, you know what I mean?
Well, fishing blind. That's a conversation. That's a whole other tip, but it's a good tip to go down. Why not? It's with like Herbie, you know, it's a trick that I've learned from him and something I apply in my guiding, and try to give a moderate brief explanation. And this will apply, say, because anybody that, if you own the boat and you're taking somebody and it's not their boat, it could be your cousin Eddie's girlfriend's brother, right? You're guiding, you're unpaid guiding if it's your boat and your shit, right?
Give them the heads up of, hey, we're about to hit a reef. It's going to be on your port side about 100 feet out. Right. But to the point of to wrap it, like I said, on the saturation and the proximity of there is nothing. There's absolutely nothing more that I'm certain of in muskie fishing. Of, I'd bet the boat and I bet my life on it. That is the most important element of what we do is closing the proximity gap. Right? And lure selection is simply a conditional display of that. Right?
Yeah.
What is the logical proximity based on conditions? What tools do I have that close the proximity gap the best that I can do? And then the other decisions are a hierarchy of seasonality, forage availability, things of that nature, right? So that's why one might need a super fast sinking glide bait, because that's what they respond to, because action will have different responses, right? And so proximity will get you where you need to be. And you always hear these outliers, Jay. There's always an outlier to a thing, and we bring that up because everybody's got the story. And that's all good and well, but most of the time, you're going to be 98% of where you want to be if you're focused on the logical, proximity-based decision-making with proximity in mind, right? Where are they at? That's the most important thing. And then how do I get a bait as close to them as I can? That's it.
I agree.
If they're in the weed tops, give me a Titan, give me a bucktail. I mean, the first 5 feet, and then hell, I mean, there's so much of what we have. So many of our tools are, like I said, 5 foot and up.
Yeah, they are.
5 foot and up. And then you see it. I see guys go through this development arc. You know, it's funny. We're talking about, I was talking with a guy that's in the biz here, talking about people coming and going. You know, here's Johnny's guide service, and Johnny's guide service comes out hot shit for a year and a half, and then, you know, one freaking unexpected pregnancy away from never hearing from him again, you know? Mm-hmm. And, you know, you look at that, and you look at this, and you look at this, and blah, 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 blah. So there's people coming and going, there's hot, and there's hot, and there's hot. The guys that are consistent are the well-rounded ones, and what I was getting at is, like, when people really got consistent was when rubber hit, right? Because the ebb and flow of these people, there's a lot of guys that were like whole years, like they're just getting trounced. They made no adjustments, this, that, and the other. It's like they're in and they're out of the game and they're shut down and they're this, that, and the other. And then like when we first got dogs and we first got Medusas and we first got sinking baits, the guys that adopted that were like, boom. You see what I'm saying? It like solidified a lot of like it kind of froze a group where it's like, boom, that's like kind of the next generation. Cause it, you know, Bob talks about it. Well, why did Tube get popular? I don't know, Jay. We only did about 30 billion videos on them. Right. You know, and all this stuff. Yeah. And like all these guys that adopted that, like, oh, we're now magically. And it's funny. If you look at it, you go, we're now magically fishing 10 to 15 feet effectively. And now we're catching a bunch of fish. We're catching big fish and all this stuff. And
what was out there to work baits efficiently deeper at 10 to 15 feet plus back 30 years ago?
Hell,
there wasn't a lot. I mean, there wasn't when Bulldogs like came out.
That's why, like I was saying, that people come and go. Because, like, freaking, if it wasn't a bucktail year or a 6 foot year, you weren't making money. And if you weren't a troller, I mean, you've just pure caster. That's what I'm saying with the come and go nature of it. And it's like, boom, okay, you it's like the explosion of it. And it's like the change. You know, we always talk about the changes in muskie fishing and the changes and what was it like then. But even, Jay, since we've been doing the podcast and since we were doing videos at Muskie Shop, the changes. You know, it's a different world. You know, it's like when you look back in retrospect, you go, well, how the shift has taken place. And then, you know, we're squarely in the live scope information range that just keeps going. Well, this is far righter than where we were. This is far more dialed in than you were before, you know what I'm saying? As far as what's happening and taking place. Mm. Sorry for the rabbit holes. They just don't end, Jay.
No, they never do. That's a good thing, though.
Josh, what should I use while fishing for muskies that are very pressured and stressed in a semi-urban? Are they stressed from angling pressure? Or are they stressed from living in a semi-urban river? Jay, that's the question. So they're pressured and stressed in a semi-urban. Did they tell you they're stressed? Hello.
You can tell.
Hey, they're a little twitchy. Smoking a lot more than they should be. Helen left me. Here I am trying to eat this bluegill. I'm not nervous. Yeah. You're nervous. Anyway. Very pressured and stressed. I will just take his word from it. These muskies have had a hard go over here. Things, chips have been down. They're stressed.
Let me worry.
You know, tax time's coming around as always does. They're stressed to the hill. Semi-urban. Say no more. He says, I saw a lot of muskies jumping out in the middle of the river and a lot of couple feet offshore, not eating anything from bucktails and big swim baits or small bass lures. You know, what do we do here? You know, if we're seeing semi-urban, that means, and I'm just teasing, I'm sure these fish see a bunch of lures and a bunch of guys, you know, that when we get into areas like that and access to the fish is pretty easy, right? You get at home
in
off.
Common, yeah.
In common, yeah. You get home off work, you know.
Yeah,
you,
right,
you,
right, right.
You eat supper and you go make a few casts. And it's funny, like, the whole time I'm thinking about over in the Netherlands, it's like we're fishing these canals and it's like literally have just an amazing meal, right? Smoke a fag, as you say, Dre. It's over appropriate there. Yeah.
Right. Right.
Go down there and you're fishing this canal. Well, that happened. It's pretty common. Those fish are pretty pressured. You know what I'm saying? You're on it. It's kind of awesome, but that's kind of the joys of being in a semi-urban area.
You get in these hyper-urban type areas. It's just like, if you think about it, there's certain stretches of water that are seeing constant bombardment.
Yeah.
Day and night.
From the homeless.
There's always presentations flying out there. I mean, these fish are just like, you gotta be kidding me.
We got bums throwing topwaters. No.
Yeah.
Now, I mean, if I'm in a pressured zone, and like I said, I'm thinking about those big pike we were targeting and that stuff. Show them something different. That's the one thing you can do. And it's like, okay, what is no one throwing? If I've seen, again, back to the bucktails, not knocking bucktails, but good golly almighty, they see a lot of those. Okay, mark that off the list. Okay, swim baits, boom. You know, he's saying they're seeing anything from swim baits to small bass lures, which makes it tough, and I'm sure this is really, really pressured. You know, maybe you get finessey with it, right? And I mean, so if we're going from musky lures to small bass lures, that truly is everything. But I'm going to go, what can I do that I think they're not seeing or has a different cadence, right, which is going to be slow? Maybe you're rigging stuff up and you're bottom hopping. Right. It's something I used to talk about, and we'll have a solution for that here shortly from the Livingston thing. But, like, you know, we used to talk about top loading a toad, yeah, you know, and hop and bottom bouncing small rivers and stuff like that. Try to mix that up. I mean, and sometimes too, to his point, he's seeing these things jumping out in the middle of the river and they're doing their thing. If they're out there doing that, it's about the same as the porpoise often. You know, if they're just frolicking, right? You know, maybe they're eating small stuff. But, you know, if I'm in a heavily pressured area, just come up with a new way of presenting. For me, small rivers, though, scream slow working spinner baits. And maybe you put a big soft plastic on the back of one, right? That allows you to be pretty much snag free, getting it down on bottom. Because again, even in shallow water, most people are burning it over their head, afraid of snags. If you're able to work it down there,
exactly.
Hop and bob, mm-hmm. They're not seeing that. Do it different. It's that same thing. It's the same thing. Doing what everyone else is doing, doing the same thing everyone else is doing, expecting different results.
Let's go to the same lake everybody else goes to. Let's throw the same baits everybody else does. Let's fish as fast as everybody else does, right? Let's jump on the hype train. Well, what did everybody do? So think of it that way. Try to carve out something that's productive, that's going to be totally different, totally unique. The other thing, and a good friend of mine, Ben, you know, he did the kamikazes. He's been, you know, for a long time. And he fishes a semi-urban, highly pressured body of water, right?
Yeah.
With a lot of regularity. A lot of his eats and a lot of what he's doing is doing things really slow and then trudging through tick-infested areas and getting away from the easy access. The same thought process. Get away from them. Get to places where you can, that are the cost of entrance is a little bit higher, right? You might get stabbed. Might find somebody smoking crack, right? Here comes somebody throwing the frickin' mailbox for the Chicago Tribune out of their car at 4 a.m. because they stole the quarters out of it kind of deal, right? But going the path less traveled often yields better results than what the crowd's doing. And so even in that scenario, try that. All right. Hey, boys, sounds like the bash was a hit. And Steve, I hope you're enjoying the goon. Anyway, I'm trying to get better with my side imaging. I'm wondering if you'd explain in your own words what a side imaging follow looks like on the screen. I just don't exactly know what the hell I'm supposed to be looking for. Thanks for all the help. Bag 2 and lost 1 in Hayward last week. Thanks to all the knowledge I've absorbed from the podcast. You guys rock. We might have rocks in our head, however. So, side imaging follows. You know, it's one of those things of depends on how the fish is coming in. It can, and how, what your zoom level is, right? But a lot of times you're going to find it kind of streaky if you're coming in. Like, here you're coming in, here's your rod, and here's kind of this streak on the screen, right? You're not on a side imaging follow, right? If they're coming in hot. It took me a while to kind of get that in my head when I was using side imaging back in the day for that. So it's what I want to do is, okay, are you set up in such a manner where you're figurating and you're seeing baits come through that streak, right? Or that presentation come through on the side imaging, right? Are you leaving your swoosh? Are you leaving something on there? And that's the one thing with side imaging, and that's what happened a second ago. It's not what's happening now, so you can't really respond. But what I'm going to look for is a differentiation of that. And I've seen it like kind of like blobbed out, blurred out on Lowrance, and it just depends on what unit you're using. But set a baseline, right? What I mean by that is set a baseline. And go, okay, I know that's a bait coming in. You see what I'm saying? I know that's a bulldog.
Yeah.
And extrapolate from there size-wise and extrapolate. Oh, that's not normal. That's the best way. Mm-hmm. And I'm using that as a universal way to set electronics. What's normal? Just like hell, dude, I was talking about the jigging of Bondies on 2D. Do it still on my down scan on my trolling motor, right? Got it built into the head of the trolling motor. I will drop a Bondi right under that and stare at my 2D screen. It's as good, if not better, than watching live scope, right? Here's this never-ending kind of hopping wavelength, all right? I know top and bottom I'm feeling it. Oh, there's a real big red thing on it, right? With 2D, set that baseline. Know where your retrieves are coming at. So go out and play in open water. Play somewhere where you go, okay, cool. That's crankbait coming in. That's bulldog coming in. That's a this coming in. Boom, that's not normal, right? That's the best way I can explain it to you to kind of get a feel for it. Jerry, the bite here in Ontario has been tough. Do you guys think turnover will change that? Pooh, prediction.
Well, it sounds like you already saw stabilization the last week here.
Saw stabilization, August, yeah. So, yeah. I mean, and his question could be an extra week older, who knows? The thing is, this stabilized now, back gets pretty good. Are they gonna take all the dice in the Yahtzee Cup and shake it up and throw it out again? Who knows? You know, turnover is one of those times where it kind of reshuffles the deck, right? You get
just muskies everywhere, bait fish everywhere, and it kind of resets a system. So that's the way to look at it. Maybe things are turning around now. And there's different bodies of water, man. It's still tough in a lot of places. There's better weeks, but there's still bad weeks going down on some lakes up there, major lakes. You know, and it's just like, it's not just one or two. It's you know, there's people that are on, there's people that are off, there's lakes that are on, there's lakes that are off. So hopefully when the turnover
I mean, we're inches from a transition out here. I mean, I already saw that the other day. I went out and, you know, notice bait fish, you know, small stuff in the shallows. I just went out shore fishing after work the other night, you know, type deal. And, you know, that was after a couple really cold nights, you know, where it got down to 42 degrees. And it's like the water temp had dropped significantly at that point. This was a few days ago. And that's all it takes to get that thing, you know, kicking in. So we're, like I said, we're inches away from September. And that stuff, that whole scenario is, you know, a lot of people live for that because, you know, a shallow environment is all of a sudden opened up because of this abundance of forage. Because of the cooling of the water, so
here's if you're having it tough, here's hoping. Will it change? Right. That's the one thing. Change is inevitable. It's just like I was talking earlier about ebbing and flowing. Change is inevitable throughout the day. Change is inevitable throughout the hour. It is inevitable throughout the week. It is inevitable throughout everything. Right. And it's the and it's what I have to remind myself that you still suck at this. Right. And it's like if it was like truly like next freaking you would be able to know like through you could stay dialed all day long. Right. And we're just getting glimpses and we're getting this. And some of us are ahead a little bit. Some of us are not. Some of us are in a little bit. You have your days. You have your this. But that's the thing with like turnover coming or the seasonality coming. It is never the same it was yesterday. You know, and that's what you got to remind yourself, if, especially when you have a bad day, because there's a lot of, like I said, a lot of people having bad destination trips this year, is just don't do like, the same thing you did yesterday.
Yeah, and you said it's not the same throughout the day. I mean, is the temperature the same throughout the day? Is the barometric pressure the same throughout the day?
No.
Everything's always changing. Is the wind direction always changing a bit? Yeah, of course.
I've asked people before, and it's just like, and it's just sometimes when you turn the mirror on yourself to understand things. Do you feel the same all day?
There you go.
You don't, right? You know, be honest.
Right now, I'm really sad.
Yeah, I'm real good. Should be. I've got a list of reasons you should remain that way. But it's just like
it's thundering out. Hello.
But it's like it's like hell. Got here this morning or last night and get home and it's like this morning I felt like a mortal shit. You know, it's like, feel better now, feel this, feel that. So nothing is stable.
We should put yourself in the mind of the musk.
Well, put yourself in reality, which is once again, hell, playing therapist, you're in control of nothing. You're just here. That's the one thing that it's like when we're talking about going to the context clues, we're going, you know, this, or it's like when I had Clun on. And you're just trying to like, okay, be there and be present enough to pay attention. And then you extrapolate from that and you go, well, what's logical or what's not? And even logic probably doesn't apply. You know, it's this like, you're just kind of like not trying to force it in all things. Because if you force, it's like one of those things with anything. If you force something, it usually doesn't work. If you have to force it, it either doesn't work or doesn't last long. If it just works, it just works. And I think that's one of the hardest things with the personality types we have in musky fishing is you don't want to admit you're wrong. Right? I'm wrong most of the day. I'm just right once or twice a day more so than others, which is pathetic. If you're, you know what I'm saying? It's just like, I just, if you take my gut feelings on the water and my reads on the water, 99.9% of them are wrong. Right? 99%. My head goes, we should probably do this. We should position on this. We should try this. We should try that. We should do this. We should do that. Well, it feels like you're the hero of the day or king for the day because you were right and you got that one. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And you're not looking back and going, well, everything I did for 11 hours or 10 hours or 5 hours or 6 hours or whatever it was fundamentally non-productive. Right? It might have led you to that decision. You may have, okay, well, I did this and I eliminated that, and that's productive in and of itself, but the reality of it is like, okay, fundamentally, it wasn't right. So that's the way to look at it. And so, you know, the best thing you can do with these fish is just never say you know anything. You know, and just go, what's logically makes the best, most sense, you know? And I have my days. Hell, I have it on the podcast here. We're strutting around like a banty rooster, like I really know some shit. But at the core of the matter, it's like being able to just constantly flux, I think, is the most important thing you can do, and just constantly adjust and just go, well, I know nothing. I just know what the environment is presenting me and my electronics are presenting me.
At the bare minimum, constant adjustments applies. Yeah. There you go. I mean, you know, even if it's ineffective.
Yeah, well, it's something. It's like I said.
Yeah, your odds just went up. Yeah.
This isn't working. The number one thing is
make an adjustment.
Right. Yeah. Make an adjustment, make an assessment. Anyway, God, we still haven't caught up on these and I'm still prattling along and talking about crap no one cares about, Jay, as always. Anyway, it's good to be home. We're back on the schedule here. I promise you we'll be back and rooting tooting every Sunday night from now on out here.
Ish. Yeah. Ish. Right.
So it's hard with the travel. But anyway, Jaybird, say a vita zane.
Back in the saddle, Steve.
Later, Dave.
Night, guys.
Yeah. Bye-bye.